History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned that they don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it before it's too late. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we're definitely educated, we're always entertained, and if we're listening for the heart behind the story, it's pretty easy to draw inspiration from these stories from our greatest generation. The centenarian we get to meet today is still serving his fellow veterans in Albuquerque, New Mexico, despite being legally blind for more than a decade. Ellis Fish has called the Land of Enchantment home for the last 70 years, but he grew up a little further east.
I was born in Freeman, Missouri, south of Kansas City, not too far. I was several months premature. I didn't think I was going to make it, and I did. And my mother had to have a hysterectomy, and we never went to the hospital. She didn't either, had it at home, and we both survived. And I never had any other brothers and sisters, of course, except the one sister.
What you're telling me is you're kind of a miracle child, and here you are at 100 years old.
Yeah, my dad said I looked like a skinned rabbit, and the doctor said I was dead, but my dad wouldn't believe him. And he was patting me on the back, and I finally started breathing. I was his miracle baby, I guess.
And that's, you know, I don't want to exaggerate anything, but I'm just thinking about that. When you hear a story like that, it probably gives you a little perspective on life and your opportunity.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had a wonderful life. I had a wonderful family. My mother and dad were really good people and very compatible. My dad was always a hard worker, and my mother was an extremely hard worker. We never had, well, of course, during the Depression years, it was rough, but we survived.
Yeah, can you give us some examples of that, of what life was like during the Depression and maybe what you had to do to get by?
Well, one thing was people back then had no money. I mean, that was a we've had some recessions, but people had money during them. But back then, nobody had any money. It was bad there. It was hard to find a job. My dad, he'd been a farmer, raised as a farmer, but he didn't care for farming, so he moved away, and him and my mother's dad, who was a carpenter, he worked with him for a while, and then he got a job in Nebraska, 21 section ranch out there. We moved out there in the early 1930s and lived out there until the late 30s. He was a foreman of the ranch, and we had about 1,000 head of cattle on the ranch and 100 head of horses. That was the days before tractors. They didn't raise anything but hay in the prairies, because in the sand hills of western Nebraska, if you disturb the ground, then the wind blows holes there in the ground, like little canyons everywhere. So one thing you didn't want to do was to disturb the natural grasses that were growing, which were wonderful. They'd grow almost chest high to a horse. We'd start mowing hay with three horses on a mowing machine early in July and mow hay till frost and pile it up in piles. And the cattle, we'd feed them cottonseed cake, and they'd eat that hay, and they'd go through the winter in good shape.
So I'm just getting the idea that you had to work pretty hard from a pretty young age.
Yeah, we did out there on the ranch, and we enjoyed it, though. We were growing up. We were about a mile from the schoolhouse, and we rode the horse or walked. And I'll tell you, back then they had blizzards. In those days, it seemed like maybe they weren't as bad as we thought they were, but it was pretty bad. I've seen snow so hard you couldn't see the schoolhouse from our house. Wow. And I went there for all the years we lived out there. That was a little in the sand hills of Nebraska, about 50 miles west of Broken Bow, between Dunning and Arnold. We were 13 miles from town and about a mile from schoolhouse and probably several miles from our nearest neighbor. But it was a lot of fun growing up then. They'd have a dance every Saturday night at somebody's house, square dances, and people would get together. There wasn't such a thing as, there wasn't hardly any radio, and there was no television, of course. So people got together and knew each other and talked and enjoyed each other. A lot different than they do today.
And I think people hear that, and maybe they long to be able to go back to a time like that. For a boy, growing up in those kind of conditions, in wide open spaces and not a whole lot of distractions, what kind of things occupied your ambitions? Did you have some dreams? Hey, when I grow up, I'm going to do X, Y, Z?
The ranch was owned by a doctor, Dr. P.H.J. Carruthers. He was the head doctor at Broken Bow Hospital. I kind of wanted to be a doctor, follow him, but it didn't work out that way. Growing up out in the country like that was wonderful. I wish everybody could do it.
Well, I don't want to leave anything out, but as you're getting a little older, I guess you'd be 15 when December 7th, 1941 took place. Do you remember where you were and how you found out about that?
Heard it on the radio at home. It was on a Sunday. I set pins at a bowling alley. I was heard about it, and then I went to work at the bowling alley that afternoon, and it's about all of it. That was a conversation with everybody. Of course, the next day, I was in high school at that time, and I was a sophomore. We had a assembly in the gym the next day. We listened to President Roosevelt over the radio when he gave his speech and declared war on Japan. I was 15 years old at that, well, I would be in a month after. And then I went on to school, and my senior year I enlisted. I had enough credits to graduate, so I enlisted in Army Air Corps. I enlisted in November of 1943.
What high school did you go to?
William Chrisman High School, which is only a couple of blocks from Truman's home in Independence. I've been by there and been to his home several times. In fact, after he was president, and after I got out of the service and I was in auto parts back then, I went to a Chamber of Commerce meeting, and he gave a talk that night on the Constitution. That was after he was president.
So you can still remember that unique voice of his, huh?
I sure can. I remember the night he was elected on his own in 1948. I didn't like him. I don't mean that. I think he got even beat in his own precinct, but he won. Nobody thought he would. But anyway, I was up on the square the evening after the election, and he came out on the steps of the square and gave a short speech.
And a teenager today probably can't imagine what it was like in the wake of the attack on Pearl Harbor. How did you see things changing around your school and your community there in Independence after that happened?
Well, of course, we had rationing. They rationed almost everything. You had to have ration stamps. And one thing I remember was that everybody, of course, was 100% behind the war effort. Everybody was together as far as that was concerned. And the women went through all their utensils in the house and aluminum pots and pans that they didn't need or that they'd get along without, they turned in. And because we were short of aluminum to make aircraft and stuff out of. So that's one thing that I remember. And I remember if you had a car and you needed a set of tires, it was impossible to get them. The only thing you could do is talk to the ration board, and maybe if you were lucky, you could get one tire. And gasoline was rationed, sugar was rationed, meat was rationed, everything was rationed. And everything was behind the war effort. Everybody was behind the war effort. You didn't hear any protests at all. Everybody was 100% behind the service personnel. If you was a serviceman, that time you didn't have to worry about transportation. All you had to do was stand beside the road and the first person to come by was going to pick you up. And during the wartime, if you were in the service, you had to wear your uniform, even on or off the base. So we could use public transportation, but it was probably quicker and a lot cheaper to hitchhike.
And after Pearl Harbor, did you see some of your older schoolmates disappearing because they joined the war effort real soon?
Yes. And when I was 17, I enlisted. I was a senior. There were 14 in my class that went into the service that our mothers went up and got our diplomas the next spring. Of course, we went into all different branches. I originally thought I'd like to be a submariner, but the opportunity came and I decided to enlist in the Air Corps.
Well, statistically, being on submarines was one of the most dangerous things you could have done in World War II. How do you feel about that now?
I'm glad I took the Air Corps. Yeah, that was back before it was a separate branch. It was part of the Army.
So what did they do with you? What was your first taste of the Army Air Corps?
Well, the first taste, of course, I reported to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. That was a induction center. All the draftees reported there from that area, too. And from there, they sent you to basic training. I went to basic training at Shepherd Field, Wichita Falls, Texas. And that's where probably I learned to smoke and learned to drink coffee and that I'd never done before, and drink beer in the PX. And then from there, radio school in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I spent all summer there for up until in late fall, and I was lucky enough to get sent south to Yuma, Arizona, to gunnery school. And then from there, I went to Lemoore, California, which was a replacement depot for the 4th Air Force. And we stayed around there for 2 or 3 months, it seemed like. And then I went to Tonopah, and there they put our crews together, give us a B-24. We started crew training. We was there a little while, and they decided to ship the crews to Walla Walla, Washington. The pilots and the officers on the crew flew the plane to Walla Walla. The rest of us took a train from Tonopah to Walla Walla. Took several days to get up there. Then we started crew training in Walla Walla, Washington. This was in, of course, by then it was 1945. We were in crew training there for months. It takes quite a while they take 10 men and put them together and make a crew. Everybody gets to know everybody and know their job. And so then, of course, we were all kids. And even the pilot, my pilot, I think, was 22 years old, flying a big old B-24 bomber. So we were there and were just finishing up our crew training when the Japs surrendered in August of 1945. So they broke up our crews. They didn't need us anymore as far as for fighting. The war was over. They said to get a job. So I don't know how, but I went over to finance, and I got a job there at finance in Walla Walla. And they would still fly us once a month so we get our 4 hours in so we could get our flight pay. But I had a cold and I flew, and after that I came back and I came out on orders to go to the Caribbean for a year. So they gave us a short delay en route at home. I mean, you could go home if you was on your way. I think I had 7 or 10 days between the time I left Walla Walla and the time I had to report. So I hitchhiked home, but I was not feeling good. And when I got there, I really got sick. Got so sick, my mother even called the doctor, and he came to the house. I had a problem with an ear. My time was about up to be at home. I was going to have to report to Greensboro, North Carolina. That was a POE for the Air Force. Anyway, I really got sick, and the doctor came and looked and didn't help, gave me something, probably drops or something from a year, I can't remember now. Then my time was about up, so my mother called a dispensary over in Kansas City, and they sent a Cadillac ambulance out with two guys from the Navy. And they took me to the hospital up in Fort Leavenworth. I spent 11 days up there in the hospital. I had a perforated eardrum. Nurse got mad at me because I didn't tell her my ear was draining. But anyway, they started me on penicillin, which was a new drug at that time. They gave me 300,000 units every 4 hours. a shot in my hip, very painful. So the nurse, I had an agreement with her of a night she'd come around and give me mine first, and then I'd go hold the flashlight while she gave the other people their medications and shots and what have you. And by that time, my hip had quit hurting, and I go back to bed. I had a total of 58 shots of penicillin in 11 days I was in the hospital. And every morning, I'd go down to ear, nose, and throat clinic, and I saw a major doctor down there, and I'd ask him if I could stop taking. He said, "No, look how much good it's doing you." So he sent me back for another day. And that went on, of course, for 10 days, and finally they discharged me, and I went to train to Camp Kilmer. I got there, and it was Greensboro I went to first, not Camp Kilmer, but Greensboro, and then Goldsboro. I was down there for 2 weeks, and I don't know, somebody up in Greensboro saw that I'd worked in finance that short time out in Walla Walla. They called me and put me in finance. Took me off my orders to go to Caribbean and sent me up to finance up at Greensboro. And I worked up there for 8 or 9 months, and then they sent me to Camp Kilmer, New Jersey, where I was supposed to keep track. That was a Army base, and I was supposed to keep track of how much money the Air Force was spending on Camp Kilmer. Well, I could get no cooperation from anybody, and the form they gave me fill out was about like 4 pages of a newspaper. Huge, lots of things. And like I say, and I couldn't get no cooperation. I was the only one that trying to keep track of how much the Air Force was spending up there. About the only place I could get any real information was at finance. I could find out how much we paid on payroll, but if I went to the motor pool, they couldn't tell me how much the Air Force was spending. If I went to the mess hall, I couldn't find out. So I came out on order to see a discharge, Mitchell Field. So I was never so happy in my life because I knew I couldn't do that job that I had to do in Camp Kilmer. And I tried to teach a kid, a poor GI there, in one day what they tried to teach me in a week. And I worried about him, but not too much. And I got discharged out there, rode the train from there to St. Louis and Kansas City, and home. Went to the next trip up from 1956 there.
It's time for our first break. 100-year-old Ellis Fish of Albuquerque, New Mexico, our guest today. When we come back, more of what he did on B-24 bombers 80-plus years ago, as well as a more recent experience, his honor flight to Washington, D.C., and the unique way he serves his fellow veterans today. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 100-year-old Ellis Fish of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Originally from Missouri, he served in the Army Air Corps during World War II, and even after reaching the century mark, he's still volunteering at his local VA.
Yeah, I'm thinking there aren't too many people still around today who trained as part of B-24 crews in World War II. And you talked about forming that crew and going to radio school and gunnery school. What can you tell us about your role on that crew and what you had to be able to do?
Well, of course, in radio school, we had a morning of code, Morse code. And the afternoon we spent in theory and working on radios and things like that. And we did that for between 6 and 8 months, I guess. I learned to take Morse code. I didn't have any problem with it. And you had to pass 18 words a minute. That was five-letter code groups. They never sent, of course, text. In those days, everything was encoded. I could take and print 25 words a minute. That's about as fast as you can print. Of course, we couldn't have typewriters in aircraft, so we had to learn to print it. But I didn't have any trouble with code, but I did with sending code. So I would spend, as soon as I passed 25 words a minute, I spent more time in the back room practicing sending than I did receiving code. Then in the afternoons, of course, we did theory and practical repairs on radios and things like that. That went on for between 6 and 8 months. I remember one thing about Sioux Falls, South Dakota was the fact that every day it seemed like at the mess hall we had ham with raisin sauce. Every day. And I got so tired of ham and raisin sauce I couldn't hardly look at it. But, you know, the funny part was the people at home would have gave their right arm for a piece of ham because it was rationed and they couldn't get it.
Well, and we're sitting here next to a whole lot of radio equipment. There's probably people listening right now because we've got a lot of truck drivers that listen to this program going up and down our freeways, and they're on their shortwave radio.
I don't get on citizen band at all. Yeah. This is all amateur bands. I get on every morning, usually by 3:30 in the morning, and we have a group we call the Racket Jaw Club, and they've been meeting on the air there on 34.5 every day since 1985 in the morning early. And there's about at least 15 or 20 on every morning from the Southwest, and we probably got 100 stations on the roster. But every day I talk to this group, which we call a club. Most of the get-togethers on radio are called Nets, but we call ours a club. And our motto is, we kickstart the roosters. And we just talk about the weather and politics and different things every morning, and have been for years.
So what's your handle?
Stellus.
Do you have an identifying call sign?
K5IFS. I've had it for 66 years.
And the reason I brought that up now is I'm wondering if there is a connection between the radio training you went through 80-plus years ago in World War II and all the time you've spent on amateur radio since.
Yeah, there's quite a connection. One thing is, when I became a ham back 66 years ago, you were required to be able to take 13 words a minute in code. You had to take 5 minutes without an error. Now there's no code, but then there was, and I already had that. But I put it off for several years before I even decided I wanted to be a ham, and I met another ham, several hams, but one in particular, and he was my mentor and tutor, and we got along. Well, I met a lady, too, that was a ham and her family. And they tutored me and with what I needed to know and the way the laws and what have you. And so I got my first license as a novice in March of 1960. And then sometime during that following year, I got my general. Novice license was only good for 1 year, and you had to upgrade. So I upgraded and took the test and passed it. There's other higher classifications, but I never tried to get any higher. General gave me all the frequencies and most all of them except a very few, T to be able to use.
And some people may be hearing this and they have no familiarity whatsoever with what a ham is or how amateur radio works. What do you enjoy about it? Why do you keep doing it for all these years?
Well, I enjoy what we call rag chewing. That's just where we talk to each other about whatever we want to talk about. There's all kinds of contests that you can get into. Every day or week, there's contests between the hams all over the world. And I never was really much interested in contesting. I was more interested in meeting people on the air and just talking, getting to know them. About almost 20 years ago, I guess, we had this record Joe club that we get on every morning. We started coming here to my house every summer for a barbecue, and I'd have about 40 to 46 people come every year. We'd have a barbecue here. Well, this last year was the first year I didn't have one. Got to be where I couldn't see to do it, and I didn't like to be dependent on my son and his wife and friends to help me, so I told him, decided not to have it here, and one of the fellows over in Rio Rancho picked it up, and they were talking about it this morning. We were going to have another Ellis's barbecue at his place this summer.
Well, and you just brought up not being able to see well enough to do it anymore, and you shared you'd been legally blind for over a decade now, so that was one of my questions. How do you operate all this without being able to see it?
My particular transmitter that I use in the morning has memory channels on it. Uh-huh. And I have about five or six frequencies that are programmed into it, that all I have to do is turn it to that particular frequency. And I have got to where I can tell by the notches on the controls how much to turn it to get here and there where I do. Otherwise, I have to use a magnifying glass to look and see if I can see the operation. Whenever I accidentally hit the wrong button, I'm in trouble. But I have, as you see, I have quite a few different radios. This one is the one I use every morning talking to them. This one would also work on it. This one, my son passed away in March of last year, and he was a ham, and this was a particular radio that he had. And so I got it, and you have to change frequencies with it. It's got a touch tone, a touch deal here, dial stuff that you just touch with your finger. Well, I can't see to do that, so I leave it on one frequency and that's it. Usually on KKIM, the AM station here, which is a Christian station, and I listen to it a lot.
I know we're bouncing around, but the other thing, you know, you mentioned going to radio school. You also mentioned going to gunnery school. So if the war hadn't ended when it did, you would have been going overseas and been responsible for communication and defending that aircraft in the air.
Yeah, the radio operator, if you were sitting, say you were behind the aircraft, the radio operator fired the waist gun on the left side if you were behind it, looking toward the nose. The radio compartment was just in front of the bomb bay doors. If they opened the bomb bays, I could look through my door and see down forever. Because we flew most of our missions at around 30,000 feet or better. It was cold up there, let me tell you. The only clothing we had were fleece-lined, you know, suits and even our helmets were fleece-lined. Wore throat mics and earphones built into the helmets that pull down over your head. Uh-huh. They were fleece-lined also, and your gloves were fleece-lined because you get flying at 30, 35,000 feet. You can stand there in that window, and the icicles would be a foot long hanging down from your oxygen mask. It was cold, probably 30, 40 degrees below zero. Of course, the big bombers would fly that high, try to get above the altitude that the fighters could get up to.
And that was going to be my question, too. In some of those training flights, did you have any nervous moments or any memories that stand out?
About the one that I remember the most was all aircraft on them then had what we called a bailout buzzer. If the become necessary to bail out of the airplane, the pilot would push the buzzer, and you were to get ready, and when he pushed it again, you were supposed to jump. Well, we were flying in training one time when the buzzer went off, and we all got ready to jump. But as luck would have it, he never touched the bailout button again, so we didn't jump. If we had him, he wouldn't know where he lost all of us.
So you were in the Army Air Corps for 2 days that, you know, historically are significant, and I'm just wondering how they were received where you were. Let's start with VE Day, because there are a lot of guys like you that got shot down over Germany and other parts of Europe during World War II, specifically for VE Day, May 8th of 45. Do you remember hearing that that war was over in Europe?
Well, yeah, and I remember when it was over in August of 45.
Yeah.
When the Japs surrendered. I remember when President Roosevelt died. All of that stuff. I can remember the Navy's, lots of their big battles in the Pacific. I remember the submarines, of course, in the Atlantic. We sold a lot of B-24 bombers to the British, or donated them, I don't know what you'd call it. But anyway, they use them for submarine patrols. A lot of people, of course, we called the B-24, our nickname for it was Consolidated Cremator, but it was a good bomber. It wouldn't take the punishment that a B-17 would, but it would fly a little higher, a little faster, carry a little bigger load than the B-17.
Well, and for those who don't know, Consolidated was the manufacturer, but you want to explain to us why you called it the Consolidated Cremator?
Well, for the fact that it wouldn't take the punishment, and it could be shot down easier than a B-17. So we called them Consolidated Cremators.
I've talked to a lot of guys. There seemed to be a lot of that kind of gallows humor or macabre mentality. When you heard that the war was over, was that a relief to you? Was it a disappointment that you didn't get over there? How did you handle that?
Well, yeah, it might have been a little bit of disappointment, but I was, after spending, over 2 years in the service or 2 years, and we went through a lot of training, in 2 years, you can do a lot of training. I was getting kind of tired of it. And except I did enjoy with crew because, well, we got to know each other so well, and we depended on each other, and we all had a job to do on the plane. I don't know, most people might not know it, but there were 10 crew members on a B-24. We had a pilot, a co-pilot, a bombardier, a navigator, engineer gunner, a radio gunner, a tail gunner, and a top turret gunners, and a bottom turret gunner, and some of them had nose gunners. You got to know everybody on your crew, and you depended on them.
And I imagine when you went to gunnery school, you talked about that left waist gun being your spot. Did you have to man that machine gun and fire it sleeves that another plane was towing or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we flew missions like that, and we flew missions over bombing ranges, and we'd fire targets on the ground, and we did about everything that you were going to do if you got into combat, except they weren't shooting at us.
We would hope not. And I'm curious, because there's still some of these old warbirds flying, and they'll come through a place like Albuquerque and let the public go up on B-24s. Have you ever gone up in a B-24 since the war?
No, I've been in them, but I have never went up in it. No, I have been out here to some of the airports when they visited here in years past, and then I've been out to the aircraft museum there in Arizona.
Oh, yeah.
And went to the B-24s and B-17s. They got hangars there with those old bombers in them. They're complete, and go in and see the equipment we had. The equipment we had then was 10 times as big as what this stuff is, and wasn't near as good.
He was on the radio from his B-24 way back then. He's still on ham radio today, and we're grateful to have him on these airwaves right now. Ellis Fish, 100 years old. You can find a short video with him at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. When we come back, why his visit to the National World War II Memorial was personal for Ellis and his family. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our chance to get to know a resilient centenarian named Ellis Fish. He's spent 70 of his 100 years in Albuquerque, where the latest mission for Honor Flight of Northern New Mexico will take off June 3rd. Ellis got to take that sentimental journey many years ago before his vision deteriorated. What would you say you got out of that experience?
Well, an awful lot, really. I think about it a lot, being able to see those memorials, and we didn't get to go to a lot of the buildings in Washington because we didn't have the time, but we did get to buy a lot of them in the bus. We stayed at a hotel right near the airport in Baltimore, and we'd ride the bus over to Washington, D.C., and I think we were just there 2 days. And we got to go to all the memorials. The World War II memorial had just been finished when we got to go. And so we were lucky enough to get to see the World War II memorial.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that. And this is before macular degeneration took more of your sight. So you could see that wall of gold stars, 4,000 of them representing over 400,000 of your fellow Americans who didn't come home from the war. I'm just curious what you thought about when you looked at that.
It gave you kind of a funny feeling in the pit of your stomach to go around. They have, at the World War II Memorial, they have a station for each state. Uh-huh. And then they have the, like you say, the wall there with all of the stars and stuff and everything. Another thing I got to see was Vietnam wall with all of the people, the names of all of the ones that they lost in the Vietnam War. And of course I saw the Women's Memorial and the Air Force Memorial and the Marines and every one of the different services. It was a wonderful experience to get to go around Washington. I'd only ever been there once before with my wife, and we had went to the cemetery, National Cemetery, but it rained all day we were there. We had enjoyed it in Washington, but we didn't, like I say, it was raining the day we were there and with her, and we didn't do an awful lot of sightseeing.
Well, and when it comes to that World War II memorial and all those guys who didn't come home, I'm just curious, did you know anyone? Did you have any friends in high school or people you met along the way?
I had several family members that were killed. Mm. I had two brothers that were in the 3CCs right before the war, and immediately after the war they went into the service and went to the Philippines or someplace over there, and they both got killed. There were two cousins that were brothers. And I had some other family members, distant members that were killed. I don't know whether any of my classmates were killed or not, and they were from high school.
Before that, had you ever met those cousins or been around them?
Yeah. Well, they came out and worked on the ranch out in Nebraska there one summer.
So while you're over there training to go overseas and getting to know the radio and the machine gun and all these elements of the B-24, your family's already a Gold Star family. You've lost two cousins in the war.
At least two cousins at that time. Yeah. They like I say, they were killed at the very beginning of the war, shortly thereafter the start of it.
So when you were there at the World War II Memorial looking at those stars, were you thinking about those cousins?
Oh, yeah. I thought about them. I thought about, people that friends that I had known that had people that passed away and got killed. Anyway, it was quite a thing to see. It gave you a funny feeling in the pit of your stomach. And I went to almost every one of the state stations around the memorial, and then you could see the pool from there, you know, and you could see so many more historical sites, such as the Lincoln Memorial, and you could see the mall and all that from the World War II Memorial. It's probably the largest one of the memorials over there. I'll tell you, the one that impressed me probably the most, besides it, was the Korean War. Mm-hmm. They've got a mock-up of soldiers out in the field with fog coming up, and it's just like they were out in the battlefield. It was quite impressive. Of course, I've been to the memorial, World War I memorial in Kansas City, and it's quite impressive also.
Yeah, that's a fabulous museum that really puts it in perspective. Just one more question. I'm, you know, finding out that you had two cousins, at least two cousins, that were killed early in the war. Is that something that over the years you've ever pondered, what those young men might have done with their life?
Oh, yeah, I've wondered what would have happened to them, you know, and you wondered about their family because they passed away so young. They were from a little town called Lamona, Iowa, which is about 3 or 4 miles north of the Missouri line. And they lived out there on a farm, and I thought about them. They were such young and wonderful people, Lamoni, Lamona, Iowa. Uh-huh. I went to school there. That's where I started the school. That's where my grandfather lived. And during the beginning of the Depression, one time we lived with him for a while. That was before we lived in Nebraska.
Well, I'm looking here on the wall. There's a proclamation from Timothy Keller, mayor of Albuquerque, that January 7th, Ellis Fish Day in the city of Albuquerque. That was the day you turned 100. Sounds like you had a pretty big party out at your church, huh?
Yes, we did. We had at least 100 people there. People from the church, of course, and I had people from the VA, from two or three different parts of the VA, from the state and national, and from the hospital out here, and They just treated me like a king. I couldn't believe all the nice things they said about me.
Somebody probably asked you what your secret is.
Oh, yeah, everybody asked you that. And I don't have any idea. All I can say is, I guess the good Lord just hasn't decided to call me home yet. Because I haven't done anything special in my life to make me have lived to be 100 that I know of.
Well, sometimes it's the simple and consistent things. Are there some parts of your routine that are real valuable to you?
Well, I suppose so. I did smoke while I started when I went in the service. Probably smoked till I was in my 40s or 50s and then quit. I did drink some beer when I was in the service, and I haven't drunk much since. I never drank coffee till I went in the service, and I started drinking coffee, and I still drink coffee, but I don't have a lot of other, never was one to go to bars or anything like that, so I think I've ever went in, since I got out of the service, ever went to a bar only once. Mm-hmm. That was a friend when I was in the auto parts business, and we went over and had a beer in a bar once. Uh-huh. So I haven't ever been fortunate enough, I've never been bothered by alcohol, or I've been lucky enough not to have had diabetes or any real disease like that. I had a 5 bypass surgeries when I was 75. I got a hernia that they can't operate on because they won't, because of my age, they're afraid if they put me to sleep, I won't wake up. And my eyesight, that's about the extent of my problems.
Well, we started with you telling me the story of your birth, so I guess in that sense, you've been living on borrowed time for 100 years.
I guess, and I've enjoyed it. Of course, if I look back, there's a few things I could would be glad to change. You know, when I was in the finance office, Greensboro, North Carolina, I had a colonel that was a finance officer, and he came to me and tried to talk me into going to OCS Finance School in Denver, and then he said, I'll see to it you get sent to Washington, D.C., the Budget and Fiscal Office, with me. And I turned him down. And I often wonder, what would have happened if I'd have re-enlisted and went to Officers Training School there in Denver and then on to Washington. But I'm glad I didn't.
Yeah, that made me wonder if that would have kept you from meeting your wife, maybe.
That's what I was wondering. And I wouldn't have liked that. Her and I were married 59 and a half years before she passed away. We were married in 1950, and she passed away in 2010.
Well, and when I asked you about your birthday party at your church, is that Community of Grace? Is that what it's called?
Yes, it is called Community of Grace Church. Brother Harry Caesar was the one that started it, I believe. We have 3 pastors over there, and we have probably, I don't know how many members, but we usually have probably around 70 to 100 people over there every Sunday. And they're a wonderful group of people. They're the most loving and fellowship type of people you could ever be around.
Seems like they think pretty fondly of you, too. And you mentioned the presence of the VA at that party. And I really wanted to make sure we talked about that, because I'm always impressed not just by what members of your generation did all those years ago, but how you've continued to serve and set an example for us. Tell us what you do at the VA and how long you've been doing it.
Well, I started after my wife passed away in 2010. I didn't want to sit around here all the time doing nothing. So I went out there and see if I could volunteer for something. So they were glad to have me. I started working in what we call the escort office, which we moved patients took them to their different wards and the clinics and wheelchairs, the people that needed it. And when I got to the point I couldn't see to do that, they gave me the job of going to the different wards and clinics and picking up laboratory specimens and taking them down to the laboratory in the basement. And I've been doing that ever since I couldn't see to push patients.
Well, it just strikes me that some people might have given up or quit, and you keep doing it. Why do you keep doing it?
I don't know. I figure if I quit, I'm going to die. I figure I got to do something besides sit here in this recliner. I do enough of that. I listen to a lot of books that I get from the blind library in Santa Fe. Uh-huh. And I listen to KKIM Christian radio station a lot. I don't watch TV except I turn it on during the newscast. That's about it. Yeah. Just because I can hear the news, but I can't see it. Unless I move a chair right up in front of it, and then I can't see it that good. But I'm enjoying it. I still enjoy life.
Well, I can tell, and that was going to be my question about, you know, these 16 years you spent volunteering at the VA, serving your fellow veterans. What does that do for you? What do you get out of it?
Well, I get the satisfaction of doing it, and the fact that I can get up. You know, if I have something come up, maybe I've taken vacations almost every fall back to my daughters and stepdaughters that lives north of Kansas City. I go back there, my friend that lives on the other side of the mountain, Jay Sullivan, and I go back there. We used to bow hunt back there, But I got to where I can't see to hunt, but he still does. He's in his 60s, and I've known him for 40 years. So he drives, and we go back there every November or end of October and spend 2 weeks with my daughter-in-law. He hunts, and I visit. And so if I didn't do things like that and work out the VA, I most probably wouldn't last long. So I do it for self-satisfaction of knowing that it's keeping me alive and I'm helping people.
And I suppose if it's keeping you alive, you don't plan on quitting anytime soon?
No, not that I see, as long as I can get around. And I use a walker out there because I have a problem with my balance. And so I have fallen several times, and not to trip, just to fall. I tell you, as you get older, gravity gets stronger. It's a lot easier to go down than it is to get up.
Well, I think the problem is you're taking away all of our excuses. I mean, none of us have any excuses for not serving if you're doing it despite these obstacles. You know, one thing I don't want to forget to say is thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for serving your fellow veterans now and for sharing your story with us today. I'm always curious when someone's at your stage of life, 100 years in the rearview mirror, when you think back over all of that, what would you say you're most thankful for or most proud of?
Well, of course, the thing I'm most thankful for is the Lord Jesus, because and my church and the people that I've met throughout the years. I've been going to that church for 25 years, and before that I went to others, but this one has been home to me.
And is there anything you haven't done yet in 100 years that you'd still like to do?
Oh, yeah. I'd like to go to Israel, but I know I never will. But I've always thought I would sure like to go to the east over there and see the part of the world that Jesus walked on. Uh-huh. But I never made it, and now if I went, I couldn't see it.
And if there's anything else that I didn't ask you about that you want to share, feel free. But, you know, a lot of people would think of being legally blind as something that would really hold you back. Doesn't seem like it holds you back too much. Is that just your mindset, your attitude, or what?
Well, I guess, I don't know. The one thing that I think about is I have a stepdaughter who lives in Missouri, but I had a daughter and a son, and they're both gone. One of them died, the daughter died at 55, and my son died last year at 72. He was a Vietnam veteran. He served on Midway for a year in Tonkin Gulf, and he had COPD and a little bit of problem with engine orange. I think those planes, when they came back to the Midway after flying over Vietnam with their engine orange, they washed them off. They were on the ship, and that didn't help the sailors any. So we lost him last year. And my daughter-in-law, Ruth, takes very good care of me. She comes up here at least once a week and sometimes two or three times a week, and has said she's going to partially move in with me. Mm. And then the VA has seen fit to send me a lady from Simplex, which is a medical helping bunch, and she comes around 3 days a week and spends 3 hours kind of helping clean up and taking care of me, doing some of the things that I can't do.
Is there anything else I didn't ask you about that you want us to know?
I can't think of it. I enjoyed my life in the auto parts business. I only had three jobs in my whole life. One of them was with Myers Motor Equipment Company out of Kansas City, where I worked out in Independence. I was a store manager out there. And I moved out here in 1956 and went to work for KW Auto Supply, which had a couple of stores. We had one store on Central, and we opened a store over at 1815 Wyoming Northeast. And then a few years later, my boss sold out to a fellow from New York, and he ended up with about five stores, and I ended up with an opportunity to get my own store downtown. So I met a banker from the Bank of New Mexico, and he was good enough to loan me the money, and So I spent the last 20 years of my life and with my own business, which my son and I decided to liquidate in 1990. So I have been retired 36 years, which is an awful long time to be retired.
But that's why you keep so busy. I guess I've got one more question, because you mentioned a couple things about the way things were during World War II. And I'm just wondering if you think there's something that those of us today, most of the people alive today, didn't live through that time period. Is there something that you think we could learn from the way America was all those years ago?
Well, there's a couple of things probably. The one thing that I probably wish more than anything else, the TV had never been invented, because it took away from the companionship that we had with other families. And it has brought so many things into the home that shouldn't be there. And I don't know, there's probably several other things that have been invented that I kind of wish it hadn't been.
And you mentioned how united people were. That seems like that was a palpable feeling.
Oh, yes. That was a wonderful feeling. Everybody, I can't think of anyone that wasn't 100% behind the war effort. And the Japanese, I don't think, thought we could do it. And when they attacked Pearl Harbor, and we were in terrible shape right after Pearl Harbor as a country, we'd lost most all of our fleet and a lot of our aircraft and a lot of our trained soldiers, especially there on Bataan. And I don't think the Japanese ever figured that we could unite behind each other and bring this country into the war effort that we put into it. You know that they would bring a B-24 bomber off the line every hour. Can you imagine that? Today it takes them how many years to build an airplane? Of course, they do more than fly now, but it was quite a thing.
And he's quite a guy. Ellis Fish, 100 years old, of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Don't forget to check out the short video of him with his ham radio setup at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. Thanks to his friend Sophia from Community of Grace Church for connecting us to Mr. Fish. And thank you for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.